So two kind of images from John's talk that stay with me now is the expression sweet waters of the heart. That was nice. And then those fishing boats off the coast here with their hooks. Which waters do we go into? Which streams and rivers do we go into? And that is a very important question for us. There are all these different choices, and we get carried by the streams that we get put into, and they have a big impact on us. So, you know, if we go into the streams of thought, that has a different influence than we go into the streams of love or the streams of compassion. And then if you look at what we're thinking about, there's so many different streams, and we are conditioned by what we think. The stories, the ideas, the judgments that we regularly have don't just happen in a vacuum, and we have those thoughts and poof, they're done with, and we can go on to the next thing. But they leave a little residue, or they can leave a residue. And it might be innocent enough to you know, once every 10 years to tell yourself that you suck or some equivalent. You know, you probably use different language yourself. So one every 10 years, it probably doesn't, you know, leave much residue. But if it's, you know, once every 10 seconds or once every 10 minutes, it accumulates. And it has a huge over, you know, decades of doing it, it has a huge impact on our psyche and conditions us in big ways. And some of the ways that some of the streams we enter into are self-perpetuating. So sometimes we're in pain, and the pain, we have our strategies with the pain. Some people are the running away, escape strategy, some are the fight strategy, some are the hate, some are the blame. There's a variety, some are the desire strategies, you know, let's go to the refrigerator. And all those strategies can make us feel only temporarily relieved of our discomfort, our pain, and at the same time create the condition us in such a way that makes us feel more uncomfortable in the future. Kind of self-perpetuating or self-fulfilling, almost, these kinds of things. And so if we keep choosing to step into those streams will get stronger. It's possible to choose different streams to step into, and there are the streams of the heart, the streams of compassion and love that exist within us. And if we ignore them, then they're not there to help us, condition us, or condition or help the world. And so one of the nice things to do is to begin appreciating that we have other streams, we have other tendencies within us that are not the tendencies that sometimes get reinforced by how we live our lives or how society wants us to live our lives and all this. And it's quite, you know, now I have a teenage son, and he unfortunately watches more TV on the computer than I wish. And it's quite something to witness how it impacts him, how it conditions him. And some people think that being a son of a Dharma teacher somehow helps. And maybe it does. I hope it does. But he's still getting all these messages from our society. And I know in some situations it's quite tragic how those things are internalized. So what... So to appreciate that we have resources within us, we have beauty within us, we have expressions, attitudes, feelings, emotions, which if we step into those streams, they will condition us well. They will reinforce what's skillful and useful for us and begin atrophying, weakening the conditioning that which is causes more suffering for ourselves and for others. And so these Brahma Viharas, things like metta, loving kindness, today compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, are some of the most beautiful streams of our hearts. That are forms of love, as I said the first night, that don't have within them greed, desire, lust, that don't have within them treating others as objects, wanting something from other people. They're really just, I think of them as radiances of the heart that just radiate. They, when it's strong, these states, I liken it to a furnace, a big furnace which is blasting, you know, hot air, hot heat or something. And the big furnace does not need, a portable heater next to it, you know, to make it warm, right? It doesn't make any, so we can have so much love, so full, hearts can be so full, radiant, happy, content, peaceful. We can love others plenty. And it's nice to be loved, but it's not really needed, because just like, because there's so much, the furnace is so big, this furnace is so, you know, so warm, that you don't, it doesn't need to be heated up by anything else. When you look at the discourses of the Buddha for how for the meditation practices that are taught there, there are two meditation practices which are most commonly taught. It seems like the practices that back in his time they did the most. And one was breath meditation, mindfulness of breathing, and the other were meditations on the Brahma Viharas, the meditation of loving kindness and compassion. And when it becomes strong, what's also interesting is that the way it's taught by the Buddha, or it's referred to in the time of the Buddha, it was never referred to as meditation practice as something that has an object. Like it isn't, doing it towards people or towards yourself. In fact, the Buddha never instructed people to do loving kindness for themselves. It's a good thing to do, but it's interesting you don't find him talking about any object direction, you do it towards someone. And as John said yesterday, it's more of a state of being that that you radiate out in all directions. It's just a state of being. You are love. You are compassion. It's just what's here. And and it said that when it's strong, it becomes immeasurable or boundless without hate or hostility. It's a state where hate and hostility just simply are not present. And that's quite remarkable. You know, if you look at what goes on in our world, I think it's something to celebrate that it's possible, even temporarily, to have a state of heart, state of being, where that's, you know, radiates or feels love and compassion, and there's no hostility, no hate in those states. So when I came to Buddhism, I had no interest in compassion, not because I was disinterested, but because it just was not in my radar. You know, just like, you know, I kind of knew what the word was, but and then I went and studied Zen, and as far as I can remember now, many years ago now, there was never any discussion about compassion. Zen was kind of, you know, austere. You just sit. And you sit, and they had actually their practice is called, literally, the Japanese word means just sit. And you're not supposed to do anything but just sit. And anytime someone tried to do something else, you were told, don't, just sit. there was no instruction given, really, except for counting the breath, but just sit. Just sit upright, in dignified, upright posture, and don't move. And just don't move for 40 minutes, and then you come back, do it again. And it was very fortunate for me that I was given this. This was my first practice, because if I had been given instructions, I would have tried too hard. I would have been measuring myself against accomplishing something, and I would have kind of been trying too much to fix things and get better. Wonderful things like that. And what happened instead was that I just got to sit with my suffering. And I had a lot of suffering. And I had a lot of I had fear, anxiety. I had a strong sense of guilt. I had, you know, I thought that gil was short for guilt. You know, it was remarkable, you know, it's quite remarkable, you know, what I could feel guilty about. I can remember walking across the meditation hall floor, just walking across it, and feeling guilty just walking across it. It didn't take much to, you know, do that. And that was a particular stream I was good at. And soaking in, drowning in. And then there was also egomaniacal tendencies. And, you know, it's like a kind of, you know, kind of crazy in there. And remember Joseph Goldstein gave someone the instruction, maybe in a Dharma talk or something, or maybe he kind of used it as if he was very crazy. Joseph is very creative in his meditation to help him along. And he would imagine that something like his thoughts were projected on the wall in the meditation hall. And so everyone can see. And I think that somehow that, I think, kind of disenchanted him a little bit from all his thoughts. Because probably, you know, you guys are, you should be amazed. I hope you take the time to get amazed at how enthralled you are in your thoughts. it's quite a phenomena. It's quite an amazing thing. And so, you know, take the time and wonder why. Because, you know, of course, if anybody talked as much as you talked to yourself, you think they were crazy. So, you know, you're so enthralled. Even if you don't like it, you're enthralled. And, but so I guess, you know, you imagine you know, everyone seeing what you're, you know, it's broadcast for everyone to know what you're thinking. And then you probably have a different relationship to it. Anyway, so I had all kinds of strange things going on in my mind, strange thoughts. And one of the things that really was good for me was, it helped me a lot in my meditation practice in those early years, was advice my father gave me when I was 14. He took me aside to have a little father-son talk, and he said, Gil, as you grow up, from time to time, you're going to have bizarre thoughts. And that's what happens. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And lo and behold, from time to time, I had bizarre thoughts, but I've been warned. Isn't that great? So some of them were, you know, I didn't take so seriously. It's like, oh, okay, this is what happens. So then with Zen, I had a lot of suffering, and very self-conscious. When I had I told you yesterday, right, about chickening out from my first retreat, right? And then the first time I met my Zen teacher, the first time I was going to have a formal meeting with a Zen master, one-on-one, I was so nervous I couldn't speak. And he had to say, Gil, breathe deeply. So in the interviews today, I didn't have to tell you anybody do that. You were all kind of showed up very nicely. And it was wonderful. And but I couldn't speak. So in doing this Zen practice, just sitting, I would just sit there and I would experience my pain and my suffering and my fear and all these different things. And I didn't, because they didn't give any instruction except just sit there, it didn't occur to me that I was supposed to do something about it. And somehow, because I wasn't so smart or something, and it never occurred to me to do anything. I liked Zen meditation. I felt somehow trusted it or believed in it, and so it really was meaningful for me to just sit there. And all this stuff and pain was there, and then my knees hurt. You know, you can't move in Zen. You know, here you can please move, we say, if you're discomfort, but there, don't move. You know, and if you were kind of, and then on top of that, if you were falling asleep, they came with this sword and whacked you over the shoulders. So that hurt. Actually, it didn't hurt. Usually hurt. It actually feels kind of nice. It's kind of like this little acupuncture point or something, and they would they kind of wake you up. And sometimes people would ask for it because it feels so good. As long as they hit the right, place. So I would, the point being, I just sat with all my stuff, and that changed me radically. Because what it was, I was sitting open to it. I didn't resist it. I didn't try to push it away. I didn't try to fix it. I didn't try to avoid it, or I didn't get caught up in the stories that were about it. I just stayed with it very simply. I kept coming back to my breath just to be simple. Whatever I was thinking about, I let go of it, come back to here. Let go of, come back to here. And come back to here was to be, feel the suffering. And the result for me was that rather than getting enlightened, I became compassionate. And that was one of the great experiences of my Zen practice, was this, the compassionment that happened to me. And it happened slowly, so I didn't see it happening. Kind of only in retrospect did I understand how it happened or what was happening. And at first, what happened was I started seeing expressions of compassion in the world, like maybe because that's what I needed the most. But I started tuning in. Maybe something inside of me started to melt or open up or be tender. And so, in that tenderness or open, just tenderness, just being with that, because suffering can be tenderizing. It doesn't have to be hardening. If you kind of willingly be present for it and just be open to it, it's safe to be present. If you don't react, if you don't tighten up, if you don't get involved in stories, if you just breathe through it, it's a very powerful thing to open and be present for what is and not try to be in a hurry to get fixed. And so, but the first thing, I started seeing it in the world around me. And I started seeing all these people who were, I thought, the embodiments of compassion, and I thought they were so great. And then there was a sculpture at Zen Center we would see every morning. We'd come up from meditation in the morning, we'd see the sculpture, and it kind of looked like a person. It was kind of very abstract, and kind of maybe about 5 feet tall, and kind of narrow, and kind of flowed upwards to kind of a point. And I would come up and I would say, that's the Bodhisattva of compassion. And I was just so, I just love to see the statue, abstract embodiment of compassion. It just was so meaningful for me. And then many years later, I found out that it wasn't. it was a flame. 5 foot flame. Someone had, that's what the sculpture had in mind. But for me, it was the embodiment of compassion. Or a breeze would go across my cheek in the meditation hall, and that'd be the breeze of compassion. And I think I didn't have it in myself to be compassionate, so I kind of projected it outwards and saw it outwards, and it affected me that way. And slowly it started kind of radiating or shining from me. And as kind of, the cliche, as my heart opened up, as I softened, then that stream of love and caring became stronger and stronger. And then, rather than feeling guilty how I walked, I remember walking at the monastery, Tassara Monastery, and every step was a step of love. Every step was a step of compassion. And it was quite powerful to kind of just feel that presence of just compassion. And again, it didn't have an object. It wasn't like I was headed towards anybody in particular. And this idea of an objectless love or compassion that just kind of is, it doesn't come from doing phrases of loving kindness. Initially, there's may you be happy, may I be happy. But just as there, it certainly changed my life and set the course of my life, the rest of my life ever since. One of the very powerful moments as this compassion was opening up for me was I was at the monastery, so I was doing a lot of practice. And back then at Tassajara, we would get the mail. You know, we wouldn't. There was no news or television or anything there, but we'd get like Time magazine or Newsweek. Would someone would have subscription and would come in, and we'd always get it a week or two late and old news. So we'd always have old news. And so one day, this one of these news magazines came, and I opened it kind of at random. And there was an article with big pictures of the Israeli bombing of the refugee camps in Beirut in the early 1980s. And I grew up on the edge of the Mediterranean, part of my growing up in Italy. And I'd been to Lebanon, to Beirut, when I was 11 years old. So that whole area felt like my backyard. And to see those pictures and read about Beirut being bombed, these refugees being bombed, something inside of me just broke open, and I felt I just felt connected to that. I felt like that's not separate from me. And at the time, I remember wanting to go, and I have to go there. You have to be present for this kind of suffering. You shouldn't, this kind of suffering. Well, you have to be present for it. You have to be a witness. And I suppose you're also supposed to help, but what was I going to do? This feeling of we gotta help, we gotta be present, we gotta do something. And so it took fruition, this movement towards compassion, when I decided to become a Zen priest, Zen monk, because I wanted to respond to the suffering of the world, and that's what I wanted my life to be about. And so that's kind of how I took this particular route that. I didn't really expect to become a teacher, certainly not a Vipassana teacher. John just told me that he thought that he was going to grow up and be a caretaker at a retreat center. That's what he was preparing himself to do. He was learning carpentry skills, and that's what he thought would happen. And I thought that I would. That I wouldn't exactly be a carpenter, but I would have a small zendo someplace, and my job was to have the key and open it up so people and keep it clean so people can come and sit. So one of the points I want to convey here today is the value of just sitting, the value of just being mindful of what's happening to you and being present for it without succumbing to the temptation to story make, without succumbing to temptation to fix it, without expectation of something that's on the other side that has to happen, without trying to improve the situation, without avoiding it by going into fantasy or getting up and going and getting tea or something, but just sitting. And the heart, the mind, the body, it's not a static thing. There's a lot of inner wisdom to it. And part of that wisdom is the wisdom of not wanting to hold on to clinging. It's a lot of work to resist and to cling and and to hate and to fear. And if you keep just sitting and just being, all that work of clinging and wanting and hating and judging and all that begins to fall away. It begins to relax if you give it a chance, if you don't get into it and feed it. And it's counterintuitive for many of us, the idea that we wouldn't try to do something, or that counterintuitive that it's okay to feel the pain, just be with it. We have all these messages and all this kind of good sense that you're not supposed to hurt. I remember John telling me many years ago he was teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction program in Nevada City here or someplace like that. And he said that he was apparently happily teaching for a while, and then this retired police officer came who had a really bad back problem, a lot of pain. And he'd tried all kinds of things to get help. And nothing helped, so he came to the MBSR class that John was teaching, And one of the first things John said was, you should feel your pain. And the guy got angry at John. Some of you are probably angry with us already. And the value of, and it's not just the value of opening up to the pain, which, if that's all it is, you know, Buddhism is not about just suffering better. But there's something very, very powerful and meaningful about trusting the present moment if you're mindful for it. If you're really present for the present moment, it's something it can be trusted. I mean, not that, you know, you're present for the truck running down the road and you'll be okay as without getting out of the road. But I mean, especially if you're sitting this way, and if you open to your life and you sit this way in meditation, and if you're present, really mindful, and allow it to be, don't try not to fix it, but just try to be present. That's trustable. That's something you can really trust. And it's one of the great benefits that I've received from this practice, is learning to trust the present moment if I'm present for it. I often don't understand what's going on, or why, or how to respond, or what to do, but I've learned that if you keep showing up and being present, the situation is trustable. And that's true for our suffering, because suffering is not a fixed thing. This is one of the great, I think, contributions of the Buddha, to show or to say that suffering is not inherent. It's not fixed. It's not written in stone, as they say, perhaps. That suffering is a conditioned phenomena. It's a suffering, or whatever the suffering you have, is part of a process. And because it's part of a process, that process can change. That process can unfold and move in a different direction. And so when we just sit, just be present, just be mindful for the experience, make room and just really be mindful of it, breathe with it, that allows the process to begin shifting and changing. If we shut down, if we resist, if we judge, if we criticize, if we hate, if we get involved in our preferences, all those things keeps the old process, the old stream, going. But if we can get out of the way and just be present for it, that's a new stream. It allows something to unfold. It's not like a really difficult thing to understand, at least in a simple way. It's kind of like if you make a really hard fist with your hand. I mean, if you could try it, some of you have done this with me before, but if you haven't, try it. And make a really hard fist, like as hard as you can without really hurting yourself. And now keep it going, okay? Hold it really tight. And I'll tell you a story of how you catch monkeys. You get a coconut, and hold it really hard, hold it up, okay? You take a coconut, and you kind of make a hole in the coconut that is just big enough so that the monkey can put its hand in, like flat like this, okay? And then you put a candy in. Keep your hand tight. And then you put the candy in the coconut. You tie the coconut to a tree, and you're still hard. And so then you put the monkey comes along and puts its hand into the slot, you know, like this, and then it grabs the candy and makes a fist. But then it can't get it out, because the slot is narrow, right? So it goes in like that, but then it can't go out. And so it's really still holding hard. And monkeys are greedy. So then the farmer, the hunters comes along and grabs the monkey. So you can let go now. So sorry about that. There's a talk about being present for suffering. I wasn't trying to give you the experience. What I was trying to say, it was show, was that probably most of you felt there was a very strong tendency for your hand to want to relax. And you had to keep making effort and keep applying yourself to be present for that. So the same is true for the suffering, the clinging, the grasping, the resistance that's behind our suffering. It wants to relax. It wants to go like that. It wants to open its hand if it's given half a chance. That's the direction the heart wants to go. The heart wants to go towards liberation, to freedom, because it's work. It doesn't want to, you have to keep applying yourself for clinging to operate. It happens kind of subconsciously, or we're so habituated to it, we think it's kind of like a done deal, that's the way it is. But really, there's a way in which we're constantly reinforcing it and redoing it. And so just being present, being very simple, seeing it, being present, knowing it, is very powerful. It allows the natural processes to begin of letting go, of unwinding, of waking up to happen. To give you an example of these powerful inner processes of healing that go on inside of us that we don't have to orchestrate, you can take the example of having a cut. You can get a little cut on your hand, and you can do the cut. That's pretty easy to cut yourself. It's not easy to heal it. In fact, probably there's no computer invented yet that has complex enough to be able to process all the different things that have to happen in physiologically to heal that cut. It's a complicated physiological event. But it happens without our needing to figure it out. Isn't that great? Have you ever marveled at, you know, how complicated this is, and it works out? So the same thing with when we have, when we have psychological pain and suffering. The system knows how to heal, but it needs something from us. It needs our presence. It needs our mindfulness. It needs us to sit and be present for it. There's something very powerful about being mindful. Sometimes I feel that being mindful is almost the same thing as love, because being mindful is to see, and to be seen is such a powerful thing. Without being, you know, it's almost, you know, as I've said one person today, one of the very damaging kinds of suffering that I've seen as a teacher are those people who were not seen as children. And it's almost like not being loved if you're not seen. It lingers more than a lot of other trauma, that kind of thing. And so there's something about seeing, which is closely related to love. And so when we can just see what's happening here for us, we can just see and hold ourselves in awareness and presence, and hold it in kindness maybe, even, whatever is going on for us, things begin to shift. But it takes patience, it takes trust, it takes time for this to happen. And that's why we have retreats. One of the reasons for retreats is to give ourselves a time for this to begin to happen and to unfold. Near the end of my monastic time, at Zen monastic time, I left Tassajara and came to San Francisco and went to see the movie Gandhi that had just come out. And during the movie, I cried. And as I was leaving, and I never used to cry in movies before. That was like, I just didn't do that. And as I left the movie, a thought went through my mind, 3 years of Zen training wasted. No, it wasn't quite that. I said, 3 years of Zen training, it didn't work. And the next moment, my mind went through, the thought went through my mind, no, it worked. The fact that I could not cry. That was probably one of the most important parts of my whole Zen training, was how to compassion me. When I came to Vipassana, a lot of that had been healed, a lot of my suffering. And so when I started Vipassana practice, I started it from a different foundation than I had if I'd gone directly, you know, if I hadn't had Zen. And so I felt fairly at peace with myself. I had fairly, you know, accepting of who I was, what was going on, and I didn't really feel like I had any I wasn't troubled by my neurosis anymore. You know the story of there was an executive who was a great executive, and everyone admired his work and he helped the company a lot, but he had one issue, and that is when he had to make public talks in front of large groups of people, he would pee in his pants. And so the company was kind of worried about this. So they sent him to get therapy. Or they sent him to Gill. And something like that. And so then, after some time of being treated, people at the company said, well, are you cured now? And he said, oh, yes. You don't pee in your pants anymore? No. I still pee in my pants. I just don't care anymore. So, I guess you can take acceptance too far. But anyway, so this idea, by the time I came to Vipassana, I wasn't really troubled anymore with myself in some serious way. So then mindfulness became something different for me. Then it was still kind of similar practice. Just be present, be mindful. I learned to be more mindful in a more careful way. I learned through Vipassana to be mindful, to use mindfulness to really connect more fully to what my inner experience was like. In Zen, it was just be present and just let it kind of happen. In Vipassana, I learned to let it all happen, but I learned to kind of meet it and connect with it, touch it more closely, my experience. So to touch to really be present for my body in a deeper way, but more important, to be present for my emotions as they arose, to really touch them and be there with them and really get close and start seeing what's going on. I learned that even sometimes when I thought my mind got really quiet in meditation, by really turning towards and really be present and touching the mind, feeling it, I saw that it was pretty, conventionally pretty quiet, but in fact there were still thoughts going on in the background or in the foreground or underneath. And there were still subtle movements of rejection and non-acceptance and wanting to be different and stuff that I hadn't seen in ordinary states of meditative peace. So Vipassana really helped me to see more deeply. But the practice was still the same, just see and be present and let it be how it was. But then what happened during Vipassana practice is that that kind of presence and being present for the experience, being close to it, started to melt my heart in a different way. Instead of being compassionate, I was metta'd. Loving kindness started to happen. And that was a surprise. I didn't know about this kind of thing. And then also had no object. It was like I started feeling this soft, tender love and radiance of kindness or friendliness that was kind of also began to kind of be there and radiating. And perhaps the two flavors, compassion and loving kindness, arise in the heart dependent on what else is present. And when there's suffering present, it takes the form of compassion. If it's the suffering of others, it's compassion for them or compassion with them. If it's suffering inside of us, it's compassion for us. It's kind of a caring, a tenderness for ourselves. But if the suffering is not there, then that softening of the heart gets born to this loving kindness or this goodwill or this generalized feeling of friendliness or goodwill, kindness that can be there. So I mentioned that partly so you don't think that the first half of the talk, that you're supposed to only suffer. There's other streams, and it's best not to pick and choose what are these streams to enter into, what you'd be present for. But it's really good to be present. It's really good to be mindful and sit still. And metaphorically, I like to say, sit in the middle of your experience and be still. Just sit in the middle of your experience, whatever your experience is. Don't kind of hold yourself detached from it. Don't attack it. Don't try to figure it out. Don't analyze it. Don't try to think yourself out of it. One of the values of being in your body, feeling your body, is find out where do you really feel the experience in the body that you have. And then imagine that there's a chair in that place in your body, and just sit down in that chair. Sit in the middle of your experience and be still. And just be still. But still means don't be for or against, don't react, just be there. An advanced practice would be sit in the middle of your experience, be still and kind. A little extra, if you can. Just be kind, be friendly to your experience, to yourself. As I was doing, when I was, you know, at the first Vipassana retreats I was sitting, there was just so much love. I was really struck by how much just love there was. And it was almost like every time we did a lot of noting practice then, just note the experience. And every act of, every note was kind of like touching the experience with love. You know, like I love you. You know, whatever it was. It was quite something to be there. So I wanted to offer you a very simple practice that maybe can kind of do what I'm trying to suggest today. But just be present for your experience. Be mindful, be present for it. And this is a practice I still do occasionally if my mind is really wandering off in thought a lot. I sit down, my mind has a mind of its own, it's spinning off and thinking about something, and I might be able to come back for half a breath or something, and off I go and spinning my wheels and my thoughts. And what I do is I say the word here, H-E-R-E. And I say it not like you would make a command to a dog, but I say it in a very friendly, relaxed way. If you say it to a shy child or a good friend, come here, come here, here. And what I'm not, it's not a command in any kind of way. It's a reminder. Here I am. I'm here. And then I say here, and then I take whatever moments I can to acknowledge and feel what is here. So if my mind is spinning and thinking a lot, what's happening here is I have a mind that's spinning, it's thinking a lot. So then what's this like? Here, oh here, this is what it's like to have a mind which is out of control, doing a lot of thought. And then I have to do it again, here, because my mind's gonna just, lose track pretty quickly. So I do here, I just kind of do it here, to keep reminding myself I'm here, appreciate what is here, notice what is here and how it is. Whatever it might be, just here. Kind of like, and as I hear, it's kind of like accepting it, allowing it for it to be there. It's not here that's trying to get rid of anything or change anything or fix anything. It's here, and then making myself open to just for a moment to feel it and be with it. And then I do it again, here. Here. And after doing that for a while, then after a while, for me, the rumination, the thinking begins to quiet down some. So then after a while, I don't have to do that anymore. And then it's easier to stay present without using that little word. So that's one thing, one way to help you, just be here, just here, here. And then if you want to do an advanced version of the same practice, where you say here, you would add the word just in front of here. Just here. Just here. And if you're really good at this, and when you're really kind of like, the graduate level for this, using these kinds of words, you drop the word here and just keep the word just. And whatever is happening, you just add the word just in front of it. It's just a thought. It's just a feeling. It's just a sound. It's just a judgment. It's just suffering. Try using that word just and see how that shifts and changes your relationship to what's going on. Maybe it helps you be simpler. Not take it so seriously. Hold it lightly. It's okay. It's okay. So here, just here, and then just. So to end, I want to say that so compassion, karuna, is a wonderful stream to tap into. If it arises or is close by, it's a great thing to dip into that stream, to allow it to flow through you and come through you. It's great to appreciate it. That which gets appreciated, that which gets attention, tends to grow. So if you're appreciating and giving attention to your neurosis, it'll grow. But without condemning your neurosis, if you appreciate more and allow for more your compassion and your love, that has a very different conditioning. It allows that to grow. The thing that's kind of you have to remember about compassion is that a lot of religions, including Buddhism, puts a tremendous value in compassion. It's like one of the ultimate ideals. And so it seems like it's all good. But there's two kinds of compassion. There's a kind of compassion that just arises and is, and there's a kind of compassion that arises because of our contact with suffering. And so that's unfortunate, that we have to be in touch with suffering. But that's kind of often where compassion is born, is our contact with suffering. And to learn to have have compassion be the response to suffering is one of the great gifts that you give the world. It's one of the great ways of meeting the world, meeting others, one of the great ways of meeting yourself, a gift to yourself. It's one of the great ways to have compassion, let compassion for the world take precedence. It's one of the great ways to overcome selfishness. And it's one of the great ways to be happy. There's something that happens when our compassion is clean, when there's no distress, no anger, no alarm that goes along with our compassion, just compassion, that it seems to release really good chemicals in our system that make us feel good. I think they say that compassion releases oxytocin. Isn't that great that we're programmed for that? So, I was really surprised when I felt how good I felt sometimes when I was happening to be compassionate to someone. It's possible through compassion you benefit more than the person you're caring for. If it's just clean compassion or just complete compassion. I think that's enough for today. So thank you. And I think we'll take in a moment, I'll ask you, well, just sit. It's a custom here at the end of a talk to just take a few minute or so to sit again, to gather ourselves together and kind of get back into the mode of being on retreat. But before I do that, I make one announcement. This evening, we'll do the same thing as yesterday, is that if some of you leave us questions downstairs on the board, we'll choose two of them and address it the same way we did yesterday at that 7:15 sitting. Is that what it is? 7:45 sitting. So let's sit for a minute.